Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hey, green future growers. Do you love to listen to audio as much as I do? Have you ever tried an audiobook? As a fan of this podcast, you must already enjoy listening to stories just like I do. Well, the Organic Gardener Podcast has teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook. Just go to www.organicgardenerpodcast.com/book or just type book into the search bar at theorganicgardenerpodcast.com and you can get entered to get listening to your first audiobook today. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. I'm super excited to introduce my feature guest today from Three Fiddles Farm, Matthew Broughton. I met him at the Bozeman Farmers Market when I was there this summer, and so he's here to tell us about their family and their garden journey and the things that they have going on. And he has something else exciting about him that I know I'm excited about is he's a fiddler in a bluegrass band. So if there's some bluegrass listeners out there, you might enjoy hearing this too. So welcome to the show today, Matthew.
Thank you, Jackie. I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, we're excited to have you. So do you want to tell listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I guess since this is all primarily farm-related, I'll give you some history of myself and our farm. So in our pre-interview, you asked me how old I was, and I'm 4 days away from being 44. And being a farmer is a new, relatively new career for me. I came to farming 9 years ago. I guess my background is I'm the son of a Marine that traveled around the U.S. and Europe for most of my childhood without having a home. And then when my dad retired from the Marine Corps, we moved to Montana. And I went to Montana State University and studied biological sciences. And got a job after I got my bachelor's degree as a research associate in a research lab studying organic cropping systems and organic pesticides. And I had never grown a vegetable for food. I had never really had a garden. And then I met my wife. And when we met, she was already a professional farmer. This was back in 2007 when we met. And then we were married in 2008, and I promptly became an organic farmer because I married into it.
Awesome. So is your dad from Montana? Like, how come after he left the Marines, you came to Montana? What prompted that?
So my family came to Montana back in, I guess it would have been the early 1980s, maybe the late 70s, on a vacation. And my dad, when he was a young man back in the 1960s, had come here. I guess it would have been the 1950s. He came here before he went into the Marine Corps to work as cowboy. And cowboyed out here for 2 summers back when Montana actually had a lot of cowboys. When people rode horses instead of trucks and four-wheelers. and he worked in big timber and also worked in Jackson Hole and just really fell in love with this part of the country. And I think he had been infected with the West by Louis L'Amour novels. And really had this idealized dream of what Montana was. And when he retired from the Marine Corps, came out here and bought a little ranchette up in the mountains, and that's how we ended up here. And that was back in the late 80s when we moved to Montana. And I went to the university and studied organic agriculture and went to graduate school at Montana State University and was considering a PhD program. And majority of the places that were applicable for my field of study, which was botanical pesticides, none of them were in the mountains. Most of the places were places like Kansas State and Purdue and places where the mountains are sadly erased by the glaciers. So I decided not to go on to pursue a PhD, and I stayed in Bozeman. Like you said, I'm a musician, and I started a band, called Richard Creek Boys. And the band had enough momentum and business to keep me in Bozeman, and I didn't leave. So that's the short version of how I've come to be in Bozeman and how I started farming.
So is your very, because usually I start at the show asking about your very first gardening experience. Then is your first experience on your wife's farm?
My first experience was the first season on our farm. My wife did not have a farm. She worked for another big organic farm in our town and was married. She decided that she didn't want to be an employee anymore, and she wanted to be her own boss. And we started our farm in the first year of our marriage, which was, I think a lot of people that were skeptical of how wise of a decision it was to try and start a business at the same time when you're starting a marriage. But my wife and I work well together, and we powered through the learning curve of her having her husband be her intern. And no joking aside, I really did not know the difference between shell pea, snow pea, snap pea, and beans when we started. And I grew up in a family that did not have a very intense food culture. We were very much average American food consumers, and it was a very enlightening experience to meet my wife, who grew up in Minnesota with a mom who was an adamant organic gardener, and my wife's family practiced food preservation and year-round garden food consumption. And my family was a weekly grocery store shopper. So it was a very different experience for me to be with a woman who had such a deep love and understanding of food and food culture. And I was the ignorant brute who just was along for the ride. And now, 9 years later, I'm an extremely ardent and passionate organic food producer and consumer. And we practice homestead arts and year-round food consumption from our farm. And it's been such a fabulous, enlightening experience to regain a connection with food and land and soil and water.
It's so interesting because you have this degree in, what was it, biology?
Yeah.
And so...
I went to graduate school for entomology. And the systems that I was working on and studying was big ag organic, was not small. I worked in organic wheat storage and also worked in sugar beet production and trying to develop organic pesticides for those industries. When I worked at the university, I grew plants in a greenhouse, but we didn't grow food crops. We were growing pesticidal plant.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think about going back and becoming a teacher?
You know, my wife and I have long-term plans of taking our farming technique and transitioning it into education. We're practicing, I guess it's a little discipline of holistic landscape and soil management, native cover cropping, and nutrient cycle management that's very much not in line with what I guess the contemporary organic industry is practicing. and that's...
Yeah, because you seem to have like a knowledge base. Like you have this very scientific background. You know what it's like to teach and go through those classes and be a student of those subjects. And then you've gone out and done this other project on your own with your wife. And I've heard a lot of people complain about the fact that if you go to school to get a degree, it's a very different learning and different set of, you know, management principles to what, you know, a lot of times we know as best practices for organics today. So sure. I just think, and especially if you were interested in getting your PhD at one point and then didn't because you like to stay in Montana, I can totally understand that. So do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Well, we're just in the start of the growing season right now. We're just transitioning from spring cool season to
Well, it could be from last season too. It could be from like last summer, or maybe something that grew this spring, like peas or.
Sure. Well, things that grow well for us on our farm and that are a focus of our production system are lettuces and head lettuce in particular. And we also grow lots of solanaceous crops in the greenhouse. So we've got tomatoes and peppers. That the tomatoes and peppers are a mainstay of our year-round diet and vitamin C consumption for our family. So it's something we put a lot of focus into, both in effort and in preservation and consumption. So those are the
So you grow those all year round in the Rocky Mountains in Bozeman? You're growing peppers
not all year
and
round.
Tomatoes, or how does that? Like you said, you were getting food from your garden all year. Did you say that?
I did. But we're not getting food from our garden all year round. We're eating it all year round. So, we grow in a very short, intense season here in the Rocky Mountains, and with preservation techniques of drying, and canning, and fermenting, we're able and freezing. My family consumes a year-round diet of vegetables and meat off of our farm. So
excellent. Throughout... That's what we're striving to get to, but we're not anywhere near. Now, how big is your farm?
So the property is 13 acres, and we have a little under 2 acres cultivated vegetables. And then the remaining property is raised by a pair of beef cows. Also has a pretty extensive shelter belt, berry belt area, where there's lots of service berry and chokecherry on the farm. So I think we probably have about 6 acres of grass for grazing, and then about 3 acres of trees and brush and berry bushes, and then the rest is cultivated for vegetables.
Awesome. That sounds so lovely. But yeah, 2 acres sounds like a lot of vegetables for two people. Do you have other interns or just the two of you?
We used to have interns and volunteers, and it was too complex of an issue to manage people. Mm-hmm. And when we did some business analysis of effort and reward, we decided that we were going to change our business model to being just a two-person operation without any outside help. Part of the caveat of why we did that is we don't live at our farm. We live 12 miles away from our farm in town, and our farm is up in the mountains out of town. And commuting to and from the farm and weather events and all of the challenges of coordinating schedules just made it really unsustainable for us to try and have people work for us. So we didn't change our production scale. We just changed our techniques to allow the team, Karen and I, to be able to manage 2 acres. And it is challenging, but it's we're still able to produce about 15,000 pounds of fresh produce per year.
Did you say 15,000 pounds of fresh produce per year?
Correct.
Okay, and so then you sell your produce at the farmer's market. Do you have like a CSA or anything, or just sell it at the farmer's market?
Well, about 85% of our production is sold across the table at the farmer's market. The remaining 15% or so is wholesale sold to Red Tractor Pizza, who I know I read on your blog that you experienced the glory of Red Tractor Pizza.
Oh my gosh, it was so good.
Yeah, so I sell half a beef of the answer that she gets to Red Tractor Pizza each year. And so if you got a meatball or steak pizza, that was my cow, and we sell Red Tractor full gamut of vegetables that they use when it's available.
Awesome. Oh, I had a farmhand pizza. It was so good. I love that place. Mm-hmm. Bozeman's such a great place to live. And it's right across from the co-op. I love the co-op too. So what are some of the, I just have to ask, like, what's like the biggest challenge to the two of you doing that by yourselves?
You know, at this point in farming, so this is our ninth season, and it'd be my wife's 11th season. She was farming for Galpa Botanical Project at the start of our farm. The biggest challenge, both financially and psychologically, is marketing. The growing up food and the challenges of farming in Montana, while they're dynamic and difficult, it's pretty predictable. You're going to have bad weather. You're going to have bugs. You're going to have weeds. And that's to be expected. And the challenging part is when you harvest a bountiful amount of food that's fresh and needs to be sold immediately, and you're at the mercy of the customer and the whim of the market, that's the biggest challenge. If you harvest 200 heads of lettuce and there's only 100 people buying lettuce, that's a difficult position to be in for a business.
I know. I think that's the biggest thing. Like, even last night, I was thinking, I told on Monday, I'm like, I should take the Swiss chard to the market. The Swiss chard's just about to come on. But then come the market on Wednesday night, and I don't know. I've never really gone, and it's just like, I just have this one product that just happens to be. So, of course, I didn't go to the market. But, I mean, we're not anywhere near the scale that you are. But to me, that's the way it seems. Like, it all comes on. Like, my lettuce came on last week, and I had a ton of lettuce, but I don't know. It just, for me, I think marketing is definitely one of the biggest challenges. So, but you guys seem to be like figuring it out, and you're making it as a business, and you do show up at the farmer's market.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that one of the ways that we address that challenge of marketing is to so over the last 9 market seasons, there's been lots and lots of opportunities to interact with customers. And when I first started farming and selling, I didn't have the aggressive eco-warrior attitude about things. And that was a real turnoff for customers, I think. Most people that are shoppers at farmers markets in our community are not militant leftists. And so I think it became an important part of our marketing scheme to market the happy, healthy side of this movement, that food is great and it makes you happy to eat it and it's so healthy for you, and then stop there with the message of why it's so important for us to develop organic farms and local food sheds and try to break out of the corporate food delivery system that America has been dominated by for the last 50 years.
Interesting.
because my take on things, like I have like many people who consider environmental and health problems deeply, it's very easy to become passionate and become a zealot of what's going on. And I think as a business owner and a marketing director for our little business, it very rapidly became obvious to us that the marketing and the selling of the food can't be intertwined with the activism aspect of what we're doing, because it's very easy to turn customers away from you by being overly passionate about something.
That's so interesting. You know, I think this is like, you're dropping some of that. I call them my golden seeds when people drop great tips. And I just think these are some big tips for people to think about, because I'm a passionate activist and I run into that all the time. Doesn't matter where I work. Like, I am just always getting in trouble for shooting my mouth off too big and just feeling I always feel like everybody thinks just like I do for some reason, especially like when I talk to people like at a farmer's market or somewhere where I think there's going to be a lot of environmental type of people. And I think it's good to know, to let people realize that when you have a business, you have to embrace all sorts of customers and, you know, really focus. I mean, you want to, you know, have your ideal customer kind of that you're geared towards. But I think it's important to embrace, you know, the whole, like you said, the healthy food that we're all in it together type of, you know, what people are looking for. The interesting thing to me is that you guys are doing this and you don't seem to have any social media presence. Like, I couldn't find a website, a Facebook page. And I remember you telling me to go to that Local Harvest website when we were standing there talking, that you were listed there.
Yeah, and that's the extent of our listing online, is just through Local Harvest, which is pretty low key. It's just a little page that tells people where we are and what we grow, and gives some like basic biographical facts about the farm. And we considered trying to take the modern approach to having a digital presence. And it was extra effort, and we kind of saw Facebook, we saw that as exposure for a challenge in business. Like, when we were considering it, one of our I'm friends with the owner of Planet Natural, one of the local organic gardening stores here in town, and he told me a tale of woe of people trolling him on his Facebook, and he was having to spend all kinds of time to manage his Facebook, and then he had to have an employee help him because it was becoming too cumbersome, and that just sounded like a rabbit hole that we didn't want to go down as business owners. And that since we were doing direct across the table marketing and face-to-face business, we didn't see the digital side of things as an important step for us, so we consciously chose not to embrace the digital media for this part of our business.
I think that's also going to excite people, because I think a lot of people are intimidated by social media. Personally, I love Facebook, but you know, if it doesn't fit your needs, that's what's important. So is there something you guys are excited to try next year that you haven't tried before? Is there something new or different, or even this season that you're doing that you haven't done before?
Oh gosh. Well, we've been doing varietal trials the whole time at our garden. We source our seeds from some fabulous seed purveyors, the East Coast and the West Coast, and we're constantly doing primarily taste evaluation. Sometimes we evaluate our crop based on productivity, but since we're primary consumers of our food, flavor is of the utmost concern to us. So we've trialed at our farm. I don't have any hard numbers on this, but we've trialed probably 100 varieties of tomatoes, every kind of pea and bean that's available. all kinds of carrots and beets and all the different cabbage strains that are available. So at this point, in our ninth season, we only have a couple of new bottles.
I'm losing you. We only have a couple of what in our season?
Only a couple of new trials this year. We're not really trying too many new varieties, but I guess one thing that is a new experiment for us is we're attempting to grow sweet potatoes.
Oh, you are? I love sweet potatoes.
Yeah, and they're vining nicely right now. I just acquired this year a fabulous Valley Oak digging fork that is industrial grade, two-handled, all-metal digging fork. So, to be physically prepared for the challenge of digging and digging. But we won't know until we get close to the fall frost and to know if we're going to have any yield or not at this far north of the latitude.
Right. I talked to a girl when I first started out, Amelia Schimitz in Billings, who grew sweet potatoes. I mean, granted, she's just a backyard farmer and she just grew them in her, you know, for her family, like a little, but she did it. But she said, you know, there were just like some things that you had to really take care of. But, you know, our weather's been going down to 38 already in July. We went from like 98 degrees, super hot last week. And then this week it's been down to 38. So who knows? We have a frost any day.
Cold cycles. Yeah, we had a lot of cold cycles at the start of the spring for us. Our spring crops, like all of our early turnips and spinach and the things that we fill the table with at the start of the market season, that stuff all bolted and was very unhappy with the weather cycles this spring. But,
yeah, my spinach crossed. Bolted before I could really pick it, too. That's why I really like Swiss chard. I pretty much use Swiss chard or beet greens for anything that I would use spinach for. And I just, they just last longer, and the spinach just always bolts on me before I can get to it, it seems. Who did you say you got the seeds from? Because that part got a little choppy, too.
Oh, sure. I don't think I said any company names, but most of our seeds are sourced from Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, High Mowing, Nickel Seeds, and I think that's most of them, but it's mainly the smaller boutique seeds.
Okay. Well, so like this is kind of the part of the show where we do like it's almost like a lightning round, and I call it getting to the root of things. So do you have an activity that's like your least favorite activity to do, something you got to kind of force yourself to get out there and do?
Strangely enough, even the parts of farming that are uncomfortable, we enjoy, but I think I guess nobody likes thistles, but we can come back to this. Thistles are very important part of our nutrient stuff.
Thistles are what? Oh.
And very important for our nutrient cycle system.
Oh, tell us about that.
Okay. So one of the things that's unique about our farm is that the soil at our farm is extremely deep. We farm in a beaver meadow in a tight little valley. And the depth of
in
our
a
top
beaver
soil,
meadow?
A beaver meadow. So when you get into mountain valleys in Montana, there are areas at the bottom of the valley that are very flat. And the cause of that part of the valley was since the Ice Age receded from this part of the world, beavers dammed up rivers every year, and every time a beaver makes a dam, it impounds the water, makes a little pond area, and the pond fills up with silt. And when the water stops flowing, the beaver moves, and the river continues to flow each year with the runoff, and the beaver continues to block the water with the runoff. So then those ponds and collections of silt build up and build up and build up, and I think the topsoil, like down the road from where our farm is, somebody dug a pond, I don't know what you call it. They dug a pond on their property just to have a pond, and they dug a 20-foot deep hole, and at the bottom of 20 feet, it was still topsoil. It was just collected silt, and it's a very different way than soils that build on different parts of a landscape. So a beaver meadow has really deep soil, and we use thistles to mine those minerals.
The thistles.
So
there you
deep
go.
Layer of soil and mineral below where your crops can reach. But thistles, part of the thistle strategy is to shoot down a gigantic taproot and to go way down into the soil. And one of the methods that we use for nutrient management is to allow thistles grow to maturity and allow them to be a lush, tall thistle and wait until the end of the thistle's life cycle to cut it down. And so when, like just yesterday, I was harvesting thistles that were 3 feet tall and we're cutting them flush at the soil level. Isaac, come over there. He's getting tired of me talking on the phone. So let me see if I can. So I harvested a 3 foot tall top, and we then top dress our crop with the cut thistle. And then the thistle rapidly breaks down because it's a soft body, broadleaf weed. And when it breaks down, it releases its minerals right at the top of the soil. So we're essentially using thistles to pump nutrition from the bottom of our soil layer to the top of the soil. And it allows us to replenish the mobile nutrients and mineral content of our topsoil from deep below where our vegetables we have access.
So... it was kind of brief. So you're basically kind of using it as mulch? Like you harvest
Correct.
The thistles right after they bloom? Have they bloomed yet? They're not going to seed yet,
not,
right?
Yeah, they're not. They haven't bloomed yet. They're about to. And they will. It's part of our take on holistic cover crop. That's awesome.
Nice. So if that's your least favorite activity, what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
My favorite activity is eating. Great to binge on snack peas, learn about nature and biology in an actual setting instead of in a classroom or in a city. And just strangely satisfying aspect of taking something that is is not producing food and turn it into a factory that produces glorious organic food.
I love that. What's the best gardening advice you've ever received?
Don't give up. Don't develop an exit plan. Because if... it's a lifestyle choice. It's something like, even when it's challenging, if you see this as a way of life, it becomes bearable. Whereas if you view farming as just a business, it's a extremely risky and arduous business, and there are easier paths to follow. So it's just go for it.
I like that. Like, follow your heart. If you just can't not do it, then do it. But otherwise, you know, make sure you're thinking about everything that goes into it. How about your favorite tool? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
a really good pair of work gloves.
Nice. That's so true. I buy a lot of gloves for Mike. He goes through them like crazy.
Yeah, we buy lots of gloves, and I just this year ordered a new model of glove that is my new favorite. It's a, I believe it's Wells Lamont is the brand, but it's a, it's marketed as a waterproof glove, so it's double dipped, and as a result, it is pretty much thistle sticker proof, which is
nice.
Like when we were talking about least favorite task, my least favorite task is having to take gloves off to pull thistles out of my fingers. So I think that the gloves are really important for allowing you to work and work to your full potential without having the discomfort of a prickly plant slow you down. And another tool that's really vital to our production system that I think I would choose as my first tool to take with me is a little teeny Honda microtiller called an FG110. And it's a 9-inch wide microtiller that is not a tiller. It should be called a power hoe. And it basically accomplishes the same job as a wheel hoe, but it's gas powered. And it only cultivates like the top inch of soil. And it does a great job of chopping down soft body, broadly weeds, and allows us to delay weeding until later in the cycle, help us keep our organic content up in our soil, and helps us with this holistic nutrient cycle management system that we're developing.
What did you say about the gloves? They're double-dipped what?
They're marketed as, the gloves are marketed as a waterproof gardening glove or a waterproof nitrile glove. But it's double dipped, so the whole glove is coated in nitrile, and then it has a second dip for the grip area. So you basically, it's a double layered glove. That makes it a little bit hot and swampy, but it doesn't get thistly. So that's one of my new favorite gloves.
Cool. How about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden or eat from the garden?
Everything we eat from the garden is fantastic. My wife and I work really hard to be, in addition to being great farmers, we work really hard at being great cooks. Anything that's got peppers and tomatoes is one of my favorite things, and also hot peppers. And we, since we raise beef cows, with beef are fantastic. I guess tinga beef is my favorite recipe, where it's slow cooked beef roast that then gets pulled and then pan fried with hot peppers and oil and tomatoes.
So you pan fry it after it's been like slow cooked, like in a crock pot or something?
Yeah, I think the go-to method for us is to just boil a roast in a pan, I guess braising. We boil it in a pan or in a pot in the stovetop for about 2.5 to 3 hours, so it gets pulled apart, pork tender, and then after it's cooked, then we pull it apart, season it, and then pan fry it with the seasoning.
That's so interesting, because usually I don't really cook stuff like that, but I broke out my crock pot the other day for Mike's birthday and made him a pork roast, and I had never done that before, I don't think in our whole marriage. And so I was like looking at all these recipes, but in the recipes, they all braised it in the pan first and then put it in the crock pot. So interesting to know to do it the other way. I wish I would have too, because it was like, I was like, all right, it's 1 o'clock, I'm putting it in. It's like, all right, this is going to take 8 hours to cook. And so he didn't get to eat it on his birthday. But how about a favorite internet resource that you go, is there anywhere on the internet you go for information?
Well, there's been countless internet searches over the years. And the sites that we frequent the most now are the Steve catalog sites. And I guess the
Excellent.
I guess it's technically seed porn. When you read about all the varieties and the different flavor characteristics and growth characteristics of different, offerings from different seed purveyors. When we initially got started in running our farm, we visited all the usual suspects and read all of the standard books that are part of the compendium of organic farming knowledge, and we were influenced by the leaders in our field, like Elliot Coleman and Joel Salatin, the big names. I think one resource that was really important for us was a book called The Soul of Soil, which talks very much about soil microbiology and nutrient cycles and how soil is alive and what the main players in soil health are. This is very influential in our thinking of how to manage fungus and worm life in our soil, which is that's the main pillar on which all of the farm stands. It's the soil health. And once we started to understand how to feed the worms and feed the soil fungus, then it really changed how we managed our farm and managed weeds.
And what was that book called? The Soul of Soil?
The Soul of the Soil.
Oh, the soul of the soil. I love that. I'm going to have to check that out. Because soil health has been, you know, ultimately the key to my podcast. I mean, that's pretty much your episode, I think, 197. And that's basically what it all comes down to is your soil health. And I just saw this cool challenge on Facebook the other day where it was like, okay, you're going to bury a pair of cotton underwear in your soil. And in 2 months, you're going to dig it up and all that should be left. If your soil is nutritious, if your earthworms and your microorganisms are all working, should be the elastic waistband. So this is a challenge this company or this farm down in California was doing. So I was thinking we might try that.
Yeah. But, If we have some worn out underwear, we'll give that a shot.
All right, cool. How about a favorite, or I don't know, do you have any business advice for anybody who wants to get into the industry? Like if they had some extra produce to sell, or just like if you were starting over, like what's the one thing you would do maybe differently?
Well, one of the things that's changed a bunch on our farm as it evolved is we very much have change. So as we've aged and as the farm has matured, we work really hard to work smarter, not harder. And that's a big challenge in business and in farming. When you are working, sometimes it feels like, oh, if I could just work harder, I could accomplish more. And sometimes you have to step back from the problem and try and find a different way to solve a problem instead of working harder. And it's been really key to the survival of the business to find a way to not up your mental and physical input every year. To try to find a way to achieve balance and comfort to where you can be satisfied with what you do and not feel like you're chasing something. If somebody is out there listening to this podcast thinking about starting a farm for a business, it's really important to find a mentor, somebody that has solved the puzzles and riddles that you're going to encounter as a farm business. And really try and steal all of that knowledge from the person who has it, because there's a lot. I think even in just my small community of farmers, a lot of us reinvent the wheel. And humans have been farming for tens of thousands of years, and humans have been farming organically for all of that time except for the last 100 years. And to think that there needs to be new solutions to I think sometimes is an effort that doesn't need to happen. That there's solutions that our ancestors had to a lot of the problems we face. And now that we have the internet and Google and this vast access to human knowledge, a lot of the answers for our problems as farmers and gardeners are there, and you just have to find how to use that knowledge to your benefit.
That's great advice. You have just been dropping so many golden seeds. I know that listeners are really going to love to hear a lot of the things. I think they're just going to be super inspired, because I call my audience the green future growers, because we're all growing a greener future, whether you just have a tomato plant on your windowsill, or you have a backyard garden, or you're a market farmer like you are, or even if you have a green business, because I think we all feel a lot that way, that we, you know, if we just focus on taking care of our planet right now, we can create a greener future, you know, and we can feed everybody right now. We have, it's just a matter of, to me personally, I think it's just a matter of just deciding that we're going to do it. And I think a lot of what you and your wife are doing, this, just the two of you, and being able to grow as much as you have, is going to inspire a lot of people that they could do it too. There's a pair of farmers up here, Jay, oh my gosh, what's Jay's last name? And his wife, Mandy Girth. And they are very similar to you guys. They have three small children. They've been farming about 15 years now, I think. But they started out the exact same way as their own interns, and just they have about 2 acres in production, and they do they also have cows and sheep and do a lot of the holistic pasture grazing and a lot of the things that you talked about. And it's just you guys who are out there doing this hard work just makes me, you know, want to say, you know, make sure you go to your market, support those farmers, these people that are doing, because to me, it's just amazing. Like, you guys, Mike has this little mini farm. My husband's really the gardener in our house, and just seeing how much energy it takes for him to put into that to try to grow enough food just for us. I don't know how we're ever going to get to the point where we could grow for 200 or 100 or even 10 CSA baskets. Like, to me, it just seems overwhelming, especially in the Rocky Mountains where our season seems so limited. But then when I talk to people like you, I'm just super inspired. So I know other people out there are going to be very inspired. And then also, kind of like, I mean, I rave about millennials, and a lot of my listeners are millennials, according to, you know, Google Analytics or whatever in that age range. But I think people are going to be inspired that they don't have to be super young, you know, just right out of college starting out, that you guys started a little bit later and you're doing really well. So I think they're going to enjoy hearing a lot of your knowledge and wisdom that you've shared with us.
Yeah, I started, like you're talking about millennials, I started farming when I was 35. And prior to that, I did not have a job that was even remotely as physically demanding as farming. And initially, you said you're skeptical as to how you would transition your food production into being big enough for the kind of scale of sale that we're talking about. And when we first started, I thought my company was going to fall apart. It was so difficult to do all of the work. And part of working smarter instead of harder was part of what we came to, is that the challenges can be overcome by technique and different decision-making tools than to work yourself to up to a nub. Like, there's other ways to solve the problem than just to destroy your body. So for the young farmers that are considering the start, that when you approach this with the mindset and physical attitude of a 20-something or even a 30-something, it has a very limited timeline for how you can work like that. Yet if you work in a system that is not as physically abusive, you can do this type of work long into your sunset years.
Yeah. My husband just turned 64, so.
Sure.
But definitely, well, what I was going to say, Mandy and Jay, it's Jay Cummings is her husband, and they own this place called Lower Valley Farm. And their goal, when I asked her, what are you going to try different? Their goal was to produce the same amount of food with 20% less work. So that's right along. And that's what Jean Martin Fortier, I mean, his book, The Market Gardener, talks all about, you know, being effective, being efficient, and just, you know, there's different ways. So I usually hate the term work smarter. Don't work harder, because I always feel like, oh my gosh, I'm trying to work as smart as I can. But at the same time, there's, like you said, there's always tons to learn, and, you know, get a mentor out there that can help you through that. And that's the way to go. So my final question, so we can get you back to your son, this is going a little longer than I thought it would be, goes, if there's one change you'd like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, Matthew, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Oh, that's such a loaded question.
I know.
And it's not a charity or a movement per se, but I think it's a discussion point that needs to happen.
Nice.
Globally, that we in North America, when you look at the landscape that we live in, and you travel around the country, we live in a landscape that is inundated with chemical input. Spray agriculture and weed management dominates our landscape, and is not talked about, and it's been very much non-politicized. And I think that we unfortunately have to force this topic, that these big chemical corporations are selling millions and millions of gallons of nasty, dangerous chemicals that are being applied to our whole landscape from edge to edge, and not necessary. Biological system functions very well without chemicals. And nature is a very resilient and productive mechanism of harvesting sun and turning it into plants. And if we as a people changed our discussion about the need for a clean, functioning, dynamic, diverse landscape, it would revolutionize our agriculture system, it would clean up our waterways, it would improve overall health of the landscape and people. It's such a big, long, uncomfortable topic, but it's something that we have to do. So short-sighted of us as a people on a planet, think that the only way for us to extract food from the system is with chemicals. That is very much not the case, and we need to rebel against these big corporations that are basically marketing people into applying herbicides and pesticides everywhere. Summary points I wanted to make with you is that as gardeners and farmers, one of the words that we use that that people have a negative reaction to is weeds. And weeds are a false label. There are only plants. And the plants that we label as weeds are not our enemies. They're not something that is bad. It's a tool that we need to use. When we talked earlier about we practice a holistic native cover cropping nutrient cycle system, we've come to terms with and have understood that every plant, no matter how annoying it is, can be beneficial to a farm system and a food production system. It's a tool that's there, and we have to learn how to use it the right way, benefit our end goal. So I don't have a hatred of thistles, and I don't have a hatred of bindweed, and I don't have a hatred of pound's tongue. These are just plants.
What do you do about bindweed? Because I was just talking to Mike that we have like a huge crop of bindweed coming up in our orchard that's never been there before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we'd rather it be like clover or something.
Yeah, it's a difficult one to manage. One of the things that bindweed does, though, is it has a taproot that goes way down into the soil, and it gathers nutrients from way down deep. And if you can cultivate the bindweed effectively, you can use that as a nutrient pump to bring nutrients up to the top of the soil. But it does. I mean, each challenge of a plant is its own little problem. So I don't have a solution for my idea of my new fruit field. But we just continually cultivate and just have accepted the fact that it's present and work on designing our system to work in harmony with the weeds instead of them being seen as something that's tragic or troubling. We have to make lemonade when life gives you lemons.
I love that. So do you have like a little inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden? Not that you haven't been very inspiring this whole time. But...
Sure. Well, there are countless stories of people expressing the glory and satisfaction of taking a little teeny seed, that is a little teeny bundle of genetic code, and you place it in the right place, get it wet the right way, and get it lit the right way. It takes all of that vast amount of solar energy that's showering down upon us and turns it into something that tastes fantastic, is visually stunning and beautiful, and is super good for you to eat, because fresh organic vegetables are critical to a high quality life and high quality organism, which is you. We're part of this ecosystem, not us living outside of an ecosystem. We're in it. The joy of growing food is difficult to quantify in a statement. It's something that is all-encompassing and sustaining and vital to my life now. And the fact that I lived 35 years without having a connection to the soil and the plants, in hindsight or retrospect, I don't know how that happened to me. I fear that there are millions of Americans and maybe billions of humans that have lost that connection of food production, this notion that you live in a landscape that sustains you. And that's something that I would want all humans to be able to reconnect with, that you can, no matter where you live, be it in the tropical parts of the world or in these northern Rockies that we live in, that it's possible to, with the right approach and techniques, to harvest food for year-round consumption and live even off of a small family garden plot, to be able to preserve your food and eat it always and always have the absolute best tasting, most nutritious food available to you. Even in the dark of the winter, you can be eating peppers and tomatoes and turnips and squash and all of the fabulous bounty from the summer, but you have to have the right approach of how to preserve it and how to use it.
Matthew, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your knowledge, your inspiration. I just think people are going to feel so good after listening to this. And, you know, they're going to be able to smile and know that you're out there helping others and that they can help others and they can support their local farmers who are helping others. And we can have a greener future because of people like you. So thanks so much for sharing with us today. Hey, Green Future Growers, don't forget to go to theorganicgardenerpodcast.com/2018 to get notified when the Organic Gardener Podcast 2018 journal, garden journal, and data keep it is ready. Mike and I want to help you build your very own organic oasis. And so we're kind of giving you a space to write your general garden goals for the year. There's a place to list them by month, by week, some place to record what you're eating as well as what you're growing, what you're spending the most money on, what you're digging out of your garden the most of, what recipes you're cooking, and just kind of give you an idea of what's happening with your food for 2018. So don't forget to go to organicgardenerpodcast.com/2018 to sign up on our landing page for notifications when the journal is ready. Hope you have a wonderful day, and thanks again. If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener Podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.